Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Daniel DeVizet. He is the author of the brand new biography, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. The book is available everywhere, and it's another fantastic biography. And Daniel, I love reading biographies of celebrities, especially people like B.B. King, who are intensely personal people, but when you put together a biography of somebody whose art sort of speaks for itself in the blues, who is your intended audience? What do you want people to take away from a biography of somebody who we can listen to his music and appreciate him all the much just for his art?
You know, the reason I wrote the book was to kind of explain to myself and to, I hope, some readers why this man matters so much, why he's so important. And I think it's more than just, you know, the king of the blues. I think that people kind of have forgotten over time what he contributed in the guitar to pop music. See, the case that I make in my book is that B.B. King more or less created a guitar sound that was built around the human voice, kind of the vocal, Lucille. He called it Lucille, and he was basically throwing his voice like a Edgar Berg and Charlie McCarthy. He would sing, and then Lucille would sing, and that was his original idea. And this is 1950, 1949 that B.B. King started playing his guitar that way. And over the next basically 20 years, slowly but surely that sound spread across all of popular music to where by the Woodstock era, it is the dominant, the prevalent sound. This is the sound of Clapton, Santana, Billy Gibbons, Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, David Gilmour, Buddy Guy, Albert King, and then a decade on Prince. I mean, it's everybody basically. And it came from B.B. That's why I wrote the book.
You open the book with a story about him playing a concert at the Cook County Jail. And I'm always interested in biographers when they have this massive story to tell, how they pick that particular scene to open the book with as far as drawing the readers in. Why did you pick that particular scene?
Oh, gosh. You know, I was between that and the scene at the Fillmore. So that's a train, just for some veritas there. The train's coming by. The Fillmore in 67 was B.B.'s big breakthrough to kind of pop music stardom, but the Cook County Jail scene, which is my opener, is really poignant because that's when B.B. King has become a kind of global superstar, and kind of the cost of that was that he was no longer playing for his original audience, his black audience, from the kind of segregated 50s. So the cool thing about that Cook County Jail gig in 1970, I think it was, is that it brings him back, if you will, to his original audience. And so here is this guy who's become this huge star, but he's going back to his roots, playing from a mostly black audience as a charity gesture in a prison. And I think this is so cool. And it's also it's a very striking moment because he's literally on this stage that had once been a gallows where men had been hanged. So it's just it's a powerful scene, and he's behind these tall stone walls. If you read it, it's just, I don't know, it's chilling, it's inspiring all at once, and so I thought it made a good opener.
How tough of a study is B.B. King as far as the record he left of his own life for a biographer to research?
Oh, Lord. Well, this is kind of a cliche in the blues, but all the great blues artists, there's, you know, disputes over birth dates and years and places and stuff. There's this beautiful B.B. King Museum in Indianola, Mississippi, and I actually ended up putting my heads together with them because I figured out that B.B. King, for a few years, lived in Chickasaw County, which is the Mississippi Hill Country, and no one had ever written or said that before. I mean, that's new, unearthed material, and I found it in some census forms. I found it in some archival interviews, and wow, okay, so our great hero had lived somewhere that no one ever knew he lived, including B.B. himself. I did my best, and I tried to sort out all the dates and the places, and in the end, I'm a journalist, right? So I use like documents. Like if the Memphis Commercial Appeal says that B.B. King first was in the radio listings in like April of 49, then that's for sure. If the census said he was living in Chickasaw in 1935, then I know that for sure. So where I could, I pinned the facts to actual documents, and that kind of provided my sort of guideposts through his story.
When I know historians through the years have tried to trace the origins of the blues as an American music form, and you freely admit that that's about as innocuous as anything else because it's hard to tell. So you have a chapter explaining the history of the blues in America, but how certain are you as a journalist that these stories are even correct? I mean, in as much as they're more tradition than fact.
Yeah, I mean, if you really wanted to, you know, there's been some terrific books just about Robert Johnson just in the last few years, and I mean these stories evolve, and I assume we get closer to the truth over the years, but maybe we don't. I mean, because more and more time is passing since these famous people passed away. I tried where I could to triangulate and to, you know, use the most commonly accepted dates and places and stuff, and to get past some of the mythology that we had back in the 50s and 60s when these artists were first coming to prominence. You know, fortunately, everybody now can use like Ancestry.com and Newspapers.com and all this public, you know, documentation that was very hard to get 30, 40 years ago is readily available now. So that clears up some of this stuff. Like, you'll see a little more consensus now on like where and when John Lee Hooker was born, for example, than you would have had 50 years ago.
I'm chatting with Daniel Devizet about his brand new biography, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. The book's available everywhere. And, you know, I think it's always interesting when you have somebody like B.B. King. When I listen to his music, I think of him as the artist. You never think of him as the businessman. And so what did you find about his business sense as far as being a musician? Because ultimately, that's what it's about. And there has to be that intersection of art and commerce at some point.
B.B. King was a musical genius, I think, you know, on a par with someone like a Miles Davis. I interviewed many, many times his ex-wife, Sue. Now, Sue was probably a financial genius, or at least very, very good with money, and people like Sue tried their best to kind of manage BB's financial concerns. BB himself was not necessarily a business guy, but he was able to put his ego in check successfully enough that he employed a series of people who looked after the store, so to speak. Polly Walker was this wonderful woman in Memphis who basically ran his Memphis business office for, like, I don't know, decades. Sid Seidenberg, who's a kind of a legendary figure in and of himself, was BB's manager, and kind of they collaborated to raise BB up to the level that he reached. This is, you know, all of the talent was BB's and the genius was BB's, but Sid had the acumen to get him, you know, in 90 different countries and to help him steer his way through 17,000 performances, which I think is more than anyone else probably ever did. So he had characters like that throughout his life who collaborated with him and sort of handled the business side of things. And he was able to trust people, and he found good people to work with him.
You talked about the Fillmore performance, and that was the performance, I think that was the one where he was crying. And so can you describe that scene for us, that why that was such a watershed moment for him?
Yeah, well, so BB started around 1950, and this was when our music industry was woefully segregated. So for the first 10, 15 years, BB King is primarily, almost exclusively, a black artist, you know, ringing up number one hits on the rhythm and blues charts that white people pretty much didn't hear. And what happens is, it's circuitous, but his sound gradually spreads over to Britain, where the segregation isn't as complete. And so people like Mick Jagger and Jimmy Page and David Gilmour and Peter Green, you know, these are familiar names, heard his stuff and fell in love with it and built their own guitar sounds around BB's guitar sound. And then this is very circuitous, but they imported it back to the United States. And the bizarre thing is that America's pop guitarists really didn't know B.B. King's sound because they'd been shielded from it by this sort of wall between white and black music. But by the closing years of the 60s, all of these American rock bands and blues bands were starting to kind of celebrate the sound, which I know and now the world kind of knows is B.B. King's sound. So it was kind of re-imported back into the United States. And so that's the background for this Fillmore gig. This is Bill Graham's Fillmore in San Francisco. It's in 1967, and B.B. takes the stage, and this is how messed up our music industry was. He literally had never played pretty much to white people ever before. and it's kind of his, you know, introduction to white pop fans, basically. And from that moment, in 1967, he is finally a star embraced by everyone in America, black and white, and that's how it remains for the rest of his career.
This book is just an incredible journey through this tale, and there's so much more than just little factoids in here. It kind of grabs an era. The book is called King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King by Daniel Devizet. The book is available everywhere. Daniel, just a fantastic biography you put together here, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Oh, thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.